Chapter 68. He then requested her to stay where she was, whilst he went to see who was within. She sat down among the bushes within the gate, and Claire crept towards the house. His absence lasted some considerable time, and when he returned Tess was wildly anxious, not for herself, but for him. He had found out from a boy that there was only an old woman in charge as caretaker, and she only came there on fine days, from the hamlet near, to open and shut the windows. She would come to shut them at sunset. "Now, we can get in through one of the lower windows, and rest there," said he. Under his escort she went tardily forward to the main front, whose shuttered windows, like sightless eyeballs, excluded the possibility of watchers. The door was reached a few steps further, and one of the windows beside it was open. Claire clambered in, and pulled Tess in after him. Except that all the rooms were all in darkness, and they ascended the staircase. Up here also the shutters were tightly closed, the ventilation being perfunctorily done, for this day at least, by opening the hall window in front and an upper window behind. Claire unlatched the door of a large chamber, felt his way across it, and parted the shutters to the width of 2 or 3 inches. A shaft of dazzling sunlight glanced into the room, revealing heavy, old-fashioned furniture, crimson damask hangings, and an enormous four-post bedstead, along the head of which were carved running figures, apparently Atalanta's race. "Rest at last," said he, setting down his bag and the parcel of viands. They remained in great quietness till the caretaker should have come to shut the windows. As a precaution, putting themselves in total darkness, by barring the shutters as before, lest the woman should open the door of their chamber for any casual reason. Between 6 and 7 o'clock she came, but did not approach the wing they were in. They heard her close the windows, fasten them, lock the door, and go away. Then Claire again stole a chink of light from the window, and they shared another meal, till by and by they were enveloped in the shades of night which they had no candle to disperse. LVIII, the night was strangely solemn and still. In the small hours she whispered to him the whole story, of how he had walked in his sleep with her in his arms across the Frome stream, at the imminent risk of both their lives, and laid her down in the stone coffin at the ruined abbey. He had never known of that till now. "Why didn't you tell me next day?" he said. "Tea might have prevented much misunderstanding and woe." "Don't think of what's past," said she. "I'm not going to think outside of now. Why should we? Who knows what tomorrow has in store?" But it apparently had no sorrow. The morning was wet and foggy, and Claire, rightly informed that the caretaker only opened the windows on fine days, ventured to creep out of their chamber and explore the house, leaving Tess asleep. There was no food on the premises, but there was water, and he took advantage of the fog to emerge from the mansion and fetch tea, bread, and butter from a shop in a little place 2 miles beyond, as also a small tin kettle and spirit lamp, that they might get fire without smoke. His re-entry awoke her, and they breakfasted on what he had brought. They were indisposed to stir abroad, and the day passed, and the night following, and the next, and next, till, almost without their being aware, 5 days had slipped by in absolute seclusion, not a sight or sound of a human being disturbing their peacefulness, such as it was. The changes of the weather were their only events, the birds of the New Forest their only company. By tacit consent they hardly once spoke of any incident of the past subsequent to their wedding day. The gloomy intervening time seemed to sink into chaos, over which the present and prior times closed, as if it never had been. Whenever he suggested that they should leave their shelter and go forwards towards Southampton or London, she showed a strange unwillingness to move. "Why should we put an end to all that's sweet and lovely?" she deprecated. "That must come will come. And, looking through the shutter chink colon all is trouble outside there, inside here content." He peeped out also. It was quite true. Within was affection, union, error forgiven. Outside was the inexorable. And, she said, pressing her cheek against his, I fear that what you think of me now may not last. I do not wish to outlive your present feeling for me. I would rather not. I would rather be dead and buried when the time comes for you to despise me, so that it may never be known to me that you despised me. I cannot ever despise you. I also hope that. But considering what my life had been, I cannot see why any man should, sooner or later, be able to help despising me. How wickedly mad I was! Yet formerly I never could bear to hurt a fly or a worm, and the sight of a bird in a cage used often to make me cry. They remained yet another day. In the night the dull sky cleared, and the result was that the old caretaker at the cottage awoke early. The brilliant sunrise made her unusually brisk. She decided to open the contiguous mansion immediately, and to air it thoroughly on such a day. Thus it occurred that, having arrived and opened the lower rooms before 6 o'clock, she ascended to the bedchambers, and was about to turn the handle of the one wherein they lay. At that moment she fancied she could hear the breathing of persons within. Her slippers and her antiquity had rendered her progress a noiseless one so far, and she made for instant retreat. Then, deeming that her hearing might have deceived her, she turned anew to the door and softly tried the handle. The lock was out of order, but a piece of furniture had been moved forward on the inside, which prevented her opening the door more than an inch or two. A stream of morning light through the shutter chink fell upon the faces of the pair, wrapped in profound slumber, Tess's lips being parted like a half-opened flower near his cheek. The caretaker was so struck with their innocent appearance, and with the elegance of Tessa's gown hanging across a chair, her silk stockings beside it, the pretty parasol, and the other habits in which S.E. had arrived, because S.E. had none else, that her first indignation at the effrontery of tramps and vagabonds gave way to a momentary sentimentality over this genteel elopement, as it seemed. She closed the door, and withdrew as softly as S.E. had come, to go and consult with her neighbors on the odd discovery. Not more than a minute had elapsed after her withdrawal when Tess woke, and then Claire. Both had a sense that something had disturbed them, though they could not say what, and the uneasy feeling which it engendered grew stronger. As soon as he was dressed he narrowly scanned the lawn through the 2 or 3 inches of shutter chink. I think we will leave at once, said he. Tea is a fine day. And I cannot help fancying somebody is about the house. At any rate, the woman will be sure to come today. She passively assented, and putting the room in order they took up the few articles that belonged to them, and departed noiselessly. When they had got into the forest she turned to take a last look at the house. Ah, happy house goodbye, she said. Why life can only be a question of a few weeks. Why should we not have stayed there? Don't say it, Tess. We shall soon get out of this district altogether. We'll continue our course as we've begun it, and keep straight north. Nobody will think of looking for us there. We shall be looked for at the Wessex ports, if we are sought at all. When we are in the north we will get to a port and away. Having thus persuaded her the plan was pursued, and they kept a beeline northward. Their long repose at the manor house lent them walking power now, and towards midday they found that they were approaching the steepled city of Melchester, which lay directly in their way. He decided to rest her in a clump of trees during the afternoon, and push onward under cover of darkness. At dusk Claire purchased food as usual, and their night march began, the boundary between Upper and Mid Wessex being crossed about 8 o'clock. To walk across country without much regard to roads was not new to Tess, and she showed her old agility in the performance. The intercepting city, ancient Melchester, they were obliged to pass through in order to take advantage of the town bridge for crossing a large river that obstructed them. It was about midnight when they went along the deserted streets, lighted fitfully by the few lamps, keeping off the pavement that it might not echo their footsteps. The graceful pile of cathedral architecture rose dimly on their left hand, but it was lost upon them now. Once out of the town, they followed the turnpike road, which after a few miles plunged across an open plain. Though the sky was dense with cloud, a diffused light from some fragment of a moon had hitherto helped them a little. But the moon had now sunk, the clouds seemed to settle almost on their heads, and the night grew as dark as a cave. However, they found their way along, keeping as much on the turf as possible, that their tread might not resound, which it was easy to do, there being no hedge or fence of any kind. All around was open loneliness and black solitude, over which a stiff breeze blew. They had proceeded thus gropingly 2 or 3 miles further, when on a sudden Claire became conscious of some vast erection close in his front, rising sheer from the grass. They had almost struck themselves against it. "What monstrous place is this?" said Angel. "It hums," said she. "Hear, Ken." He listened. The wind, playing upon the edifice, produced a booming tune, like the note of some gigantic one-stringed harp. No other sound came from it, and lifting his hand and advancing a step or two, Claire felt the vertical surface of the structure. It seemed to be of solid stone, without joint or molding. Carrying his fingers onward, he found that what he had come in contact with was a colossal rectangular pillar. By stretching out his left hand, he could feel a similar one adjoining. At an indefinite height overhead, something made the black sky blacker, which had the semblance of a vast architrave uniting the pillars horizontally. They carefully entered beneath and between. The surfaces echoed their soft rustle, but they seemed to be still out of doors. The place was roofless. Tess drew her breath fearfully, and Angel, perplexed, said, "What can it be?" Feeling sideways, they encountered another tower-like pillar, square and uncompromising as the first, beyond it another and another. The place was all doors and pillars, some connected above by continuous architraves. "A very temple of the winds," he said. The next pillar was isolated. Others composed a trilithon. Others were prostrate, their flanks forming a causeway wide enough for a carriage, and it was soon obvious that they made up a forest of monoliths grouped upon the grassy expanse of the plain. The couple advanced further into this pavilion of the night till they stood in its midst. "It is Stonehenge," said Claire. "The heathen temple, you mean?" "Yes. Older than the centuries. Older than the D'Urbervilles. Well, what shall we do, darling? We may find shelter further on." But Tess, really tired by this time, flung herself upon an oblong slab that lay close at hand, and was sheltered from the wind by a pillar. Owing to the action of the sun during the preceding day, the stone was warm and dry, in comforting contrast to the rough and chill grass around, which had damped her skirts and shoes. "I don't want to go any further, Angel," she said, stretching out her hand for his. "And we bide here?" "I fear not. This spot is visible for miles by day, although it does not seem so now. One of my mother's people was a shepherd hereabouts, now I think of it. And you used to say at Talbothays that I was a heathen. So now I am at home." He knelt down beside her outstretched form, and put his lips upon hers. "Sleepy are you, dear? I think you are lying on an altar." "I like very much to be here," she murmured. "Tea is so solemn and lonely after my great happiness with nothing but the sky above my face. It seems as if there were no folk in the world but we two, and I wish there were not except Liza Lou." Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.